Hello and welcome to Further Research Needed. I'm your host, Chris Wood, and today I'm joined by my lovely co-hosts,
Jan Philipp Reising
and Hannes Feurer.
And today we're going to ask the question, what is Soylent Green?
delicious, so I heard.
But first, let's have a beer before we.
Cheers.
Cheers. So, do both of you get the reference?
No, I'm sorry.
I want to do this. This is an experiment.
I wish I had been brief for such an embarrassing moment.
Wow,
this is an experiment for offline. I won't tell you what Soylent Green is, but I would like you to watch the movie and not with not knowing the answer, because then I want to know if it's a, shock or not by the end of it. Anyway, it's a very old sci-fi movie. No, so today I'd like to talk to you about a technology that I became aware of about half a year ago, and I've seen more and more hype building about it. It's not the only company out there doing this, but it's the one that's gaining the most traction. So it's called Solar Foods. It's a Finnish company, and they have some quite exciting technology that, in theory, allows us to create protein without the need to use plants. So I don't know.
Pretty mind-blowing. Yeah. So protein, so you basically sun in on one side, proteins out on the other side.
Not quite. It's electricity. it's electricity in.
Oh, electricity in.
Yeah.
But the first thing this is triggering is this concept of meat in a tank. But I don't think this is where this is going.
Mm-mm.
This doesn't sound like lab-grown meat.
It's not, but it goes one step further than lab-grown meat. So
even further, interesting.
Right.
How does it? I guess you're going to run us through the process, are you?
I will try. It's a lot of it is hidden, so I can only tell you in very broad strokes. But I think it's more about the. What I want to talk to today is more about the concept. So lab-grown meat is a really good starting point for this. So what do you know about lab-grown meat?
I actually looked into it before. Oh, yeah, Hannes, go first. Yeah, we go I'm hoping I know more about this, but shoot, Hannes.
Perfect, then I should start. I don't know a lot. I know the concept is to grow some kind of animal tissue in vitro, which means outside of the actual organism, but in some kind of dish, or there would be a tank, which is just a big dish, right? Where I guess some kind of environment is created that allows cells to form tissues. And this would probably be several different cell types, muscle cells, fat cells, and so on, that would create something that basically represents meat, the thing that most animals carry on their bones and we eat. So we can eat it. I guess it would be an approach to allow meat consumption, but not have the downsides of farming, of cattle and all these things, actual animals. That's my understanding. Philip, now you trump me, please.
I mean, that's pretty much it. But I can sprinkle in some firsthand experience. So I have grown muscle in a dish before, and it's actually not that hard. I did that during my bachelor's, but we did heart muscle instead of skeletal muscle, which I'm assuming they are going for. But it's one of the, if you have stem cells or any kind of pluripotent or totipotent cells, that's one of the easy routes for them to induce that specific type of cell. I'm assuming it's way more difficult if you want something out of it that you can actually eat and taste remotely, like meat. I have not tried my own heart muscle cells that I've grown.
Now I have to ask Philip, the muscle cells you grew, am I imagining this more like I'm growing cells in the lab, which is a single layer on a plastic surface, or did you grow something that kind of resembled a tissue?
I mean, it's not 3D culture like you would understand it nowadays, but they do clump together in a certain way and you can see the muscle actually contracting. So you're basically watching these cells and they rhythmically contract in a cell culture dish, which is very, very fun and also a bit creepy.
It sounds very creepy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's super cool. Do you remember what you fed the cells on?
I think it was pretty standard cell culture medium. I don't know the specifics. The magic lies in the inducing the pathway that they're differentiating into. Like you add some stuff, mm-hmm. but since muscle is kind of distinct, I think it was not super difficult. And it's also one of them that I feel like might naturally occur if you just let totipotent cells do its thing. Like,
sorry, what are totipotent cells?
So there's different levels of basically quality of stem cells. Like the question is, what kind of cells can you make from your stem cell pool? So totipotent is basically what embryos are, or like even like previous to embryos, they can make everything. Every single cell in your body can be produced by a totipotent cell. Toti mm-hmm. as in Latin for everything. And then there are multipotent cells, which are, for example, your stem cells in your spinal cord, which can make a lot of cells. They can make all of your immune cells. They can make the cells of your blood, like erythrocytes and stuff like that. But they couldn't make muscle cells, for example. So these are multipotent, and then totipotent just means everything. So okay, technically speaking, if you have like normal stem cells in a cell culture dish, you would assume that they're totipotent. But I mean, depending on how good your strategy was, that might or might not be true.
Okay.
Can we go just one step back? So back to adding the cell culture media. As a chemist, like, I have no idea what is in this. I've smelt it. It often smells. The media that biologists use often smell quite bad, or sometimes quite like soup.
Oh, it's delicious. I think that's true for bacterial medium, not for what you'd use in animal cell culture.
So let's go for animal cell culture. Like, do you know where it comes from and what's in it?
Okay, I'm going to give a short list, and Hannes can add in if I'm forgetting stuff. So you have like the standards. It's basically something to keep the pH in the range that you want it. Then there's glucose and that kind of stuff. Then there might be some hormones or other stuff you might want to add, depending on the specific cells that you want to grow. And then there's usually fetal bovine serum, which is basically a product you make from bovine blood. So
this has been my problem with fat-grown meat, is that I hope they've overcome this, but you often need to have dead cows in order to produce the fat-grown meat and feed them and grow them.
Yes.
So there might be some arguments towards that there's less killing involved in lab-grown meat, but currently you possibly have to still use fecal bovine serum-derived growth media, which is, I would say, kind of lessens the ethical impact of eating lab-grown meat.
Yeah, there are definitely recipes for media where you don't need that. So, for example, in stem cell culture, you try to use serum-free medium because you never really know what's in the serum. You just know that it makes the cells happy because there are all these growth factors in there, and there's just stuff that makes the cells happy and grow better. But there's a lot of batch-to-batch variability, which doesn't matter if you like grow a cancer cell or something, because they will grow literally on everything and probably on your lab bench without an incubator if you're unlucky. But I mean, Hannes is skeptical. I'm making a joke here, but
gotcha.
If you have stem cells and stuff, that's more finicky. Like, you cannot have this kind of like variability and not knowing what you're actually giving to your cells. So there are options where it's serum free, but it's a huge pain in the ass because the cells are just generally speaking more unhappy.
And are those cell free medias, would they be vegetarian in the kind of edible sense of the word? It's in plant-derived amino acids.
I would assume it's like basically, I don't know, and there might be differences, but I think it's basically not even plant-based, but it's basically straight up chemicals that you synthesize. So extracting amino acids from something, you just make them from scratch, like through a chemical process.
I don't think that's how it works. I think the amino acids you find in growth media for cell culture are usually hydrolysis products of, I think usually it's yeast. I think people grow yeast and hydrolyze the proteins and use those amino acids for for culture? I mean, chemically synthesizing amino acids is possible, of course, but it's a lot of work. It's much less straightforward than extracting them from hydrolyzed bacteria or yeasts. So that's where they're usually from, I think. Pretty sure.
I feel like I've looked into this. Maybe it's just for certain amino acids that they do them from scratch. For example, I'm quite sure that, for example, if you have chicken farms, you give them cysteine. And I think they make that chemically from scratch, I think.
Okay, if you know specifically, then
yeah. But yeah, if anybody of our listeners wants to call our bullshit on this, feel free to send it in an email.
Well, the reason we're talking about this is because of this company. So it's not to say you can't make your amino acids from what you're saying is chemicals, which I assume you mean petrochemicals. Petrol or oil derived synthetic routes made by chemists. But bearing in mind all that oil is produced from plankton millions and millions of years ago. So the locking in of carbon structures by plants is the only source of these sorts of chemicals currently. Mm-hmm. And what's really exciting about solar foods is that they are the energy input into their system is hydrogen and electricity, and they have bacteria and what they term minerals. So I'm not quite sure what added extras are in there, because this will be key to the argument as to whether they are doing something totally unique or if they're just another kind of chemical company with maybe slightly more efficient system. But they take all of these things together and they get these bacteria to break down CO2 and nitrogen and reform them as amino acids. And they have produced a product which they call Solene, which is it's like a protein powder, a lot like what you get for your sports drinks. Not sports drinks, but like the ones you have protein shakes powder. And it's incredible. So the inputs to the system aren't based on any need for an area of land to produce. Usually it's soya. So if you drink the protein shakes for your workout, they're usually whey based or milk based. And those proteins have been produced by milk cows. Those milk cows produce most of their proteins from soya, and that soya is usually produced in Brazil by burning the Amazon down. So what we're seeing here is a technology. Oh,
bummer. All right.
No, I'm serious.
You're very right, but I did not want. I like my biceps. I wanted to grow. I don't want to think about that.
Very quickly became very personal for you.
Yeah, exactly. I feel attacked.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. And you're feeding your child baby formula, that baby that's eating the baby formula is literally destroying the Amazon. It's chopping trees down with its tiny, tiny arm.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm not involved in that process yet.
Not sure if that's better with our listenership being in their 30s, maybe having kids now. I don't know if that's where you want to be to. But
I mean, they should rethink their priorities and morality.
Exactly, Philip. You tell them.
And now we've just given up on the Nestle advertising that we've been making millions with.
Can I go back, Chris, and ask you again? I think I didn't fully get the whole picture of the whole input of the solar food system. I think you brushed over it a bit too quickly for me to follow. Could you repeat that again?
Okay, I can quote you here. This is from the Wikipedia article. The product is made by extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and combining it with water, hydrogen, nutrients, and vitamins. The protein is produced using electricity under contained conditions inside a metallic bioreactor. The electricity is needed for the process to produce the hydrogen, and microbes utilize this in the production of the protein. These bacteria are called hydrogentrophs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who's making the protein now? Is that the bacteria making the protein from the CO2 plus energy input through hydrogen?
And I assume
so. The bacteria are fixing CO2.
Yes. Using the hydrogen as the energy source.
Right.
The reductive system for the CO2.
Yes, that's interesting. So the way I'm thinking about this, correct me if I'm wrong here. So animals and plants we have our respiratory systems where we use a redox pair, oxygen, O2 to hydrogen as an energy source. And this is how all of animal life makes ATP in the end, our energy source in the cell. Plants can also use photosynthesis, which is the process of using, in the end, it's the energy of light to produce glucose out of CO2. So they use
water.
The energy of sunlight, or usually sunlight, sometimes artificial light now, to fix CO2 into the growing carbon chain, which ends up to be glucose. Mm-hmm. And different bacteria use different redox pairs, so not oxygen water, but something like, in this case, it's hydrogen. And what's the other end of that?
CO2. So it's hydrogen plus CO2 goes to some kind of carbon chain.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that is part of the respiratory system there. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of different couples that bacteria use. There's some that live on like ocean vents that use like hydrogen sulfide. There's ones so that you use like
uranium. You could find anything.
Yeah, the iron one is super interesting.
Yeah. It's really cool because that goes into a conversation about like life on other planets and like necessarily whether you could live without, say, sunlight, or you'd use another form of energy like geological energy, these sorts of things. And they could all exist. It could all be happening on some of Saturn's moons as we speak. We just don't know what to look for. But this is interesting. It's not, these bacteria have been known for a long time. They exist in the human gut. Some of the processes that they do make you fart quite badly. So, you know, they live there. And they've been known about for a long time. I think that the key here is that the company is claiming that this process is scalable, which they haven't demonstrated yet. They're about to produce their scale-up plant now, so investment's coming, and that it's more efficient than plant-based agriculture.
Okay, efficient in what sense?
So their quote was, I think, grams of CO2 per gram of protein produced or some phrase.
Gram of CO2.
Wait a second.
Gram of protein. So then it's about energy, right?
It's like energy inputs, but also they're kind of keen to push their kind of global warming credentials right now and as a thing.
Because you could also make the argument more efficient in land use, theoretically.
Right. So, sorry, here we go. This is kilograms. Yes, kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of protein. So they claim that their product, Solene, which is a lot like Solid Green, which is where we got the intro here, is a kilogram of CO2 per kilogram of protein.
What? But that's not that little. I think chicken has 2 kilograms per kilogram. Not protein. It's per raw. So I think it's 2 kilograms per kilogram of chicken, and a chicken has
90% water.
20% protein, I think. Yeah, I should know this.
So they are also claiming that plants are 5 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of protein from plants. So this is where you'd say, make a soybean, get the soybean, crush the soybean, get the protein. So this is the whole cycle of it. Beef is 200 kilograms per kilo of protein. So beef, we know, is one of the worst.
Yeah, beef is terrible. I mean, that's cheating. It's like...
but they are saying they're better than plants, which is quite a claim and is still to be proven. I don't think... These are the company's own numbers, so I don't doubt that in the real world we'll see such good efficiencies.
Yeah, it also depends on what electricity you're using, right? Because your energy input is dependent on if you have solar panels on your roof or if you're burning... I don't know, dirty coal, or if you're next to a nuclear power plant where the energy is basically CO2 free, but you're fucking up future generations for I don't know how many generations to come, like impossible amounts.
And it's not to say that you couldn't decarbonize the inputs you would need to grow plants. So you could use methanol as your tractor fuel and you could feed the plants on electrolytically synthesized ammonia, not harbor process methane ammonia. And so you can the global warming question isn't maybe not the best example of this, but the land use footprint is what I want to focus on here. So New question, completely separate topic. Do you guys know who Thomas Malthus is, or what Malthus theorized?
Wait, can you say that again? I'm wondering if it's a pronunciation thing or if it's
Thomas? Malthus? Malthusian predictions.
Was he the guy that it's basically impossible to sustain the... Was he like the Greek guy who said it's impossible to sustain the human population if it keeps growing and we're all going to die?
When you say Greek, how do you mean Greek? Like ancient Greek?
Yeah, 4,000 years ago.
Wow. So you're totally correct, except that he was British and he was alive in the 1800s.
Oh, that was slightly off. Oh my
God.
Chris asked for the theory and you provided the theory.
Yeah, my dad is going to give me a very angry call on this one because this is one of his favorite examples he likes to bring up. And he was wrong, right? So like because...
Wasn't he wrong because of some agricultural... Revolution.
Yeah, it was like the harbor process, right?
The harbor process.
Harbor process, yeah.
And this is very simplistic. That's not, there are other things. Other agricultural revolutions happened alongside this, that it wasn't just a nitrogen problem. There was also like high-yielding crops were developed. Nowadays, genetic engineering has increased the productive yields. Just new technology in general has improved this productive thing. But so just briefly, he postulated that food production grew linearly, but populations grew exponentially, and that at some point there would be a crossing point, and then there would be mass starvation and humanity would die out. And he said that he predicted a crossing point like a couple of hundred years, or like a couple of tens of years after he'd said this, and he was proved wrong because of new technology.
Right. That means that maybe food production still grew linearly, or at least grew at any rate, but this rate was then higher than he predicted. But his general theory isn't wrong, only the quantitative prediction he made at the time. Or am I seeing this?
The steepness of the line changed as it went up.
I cannot see your hand motions here, Chris, but I hope they...
But if that's true, then he's wrong, right? That it wasn't a linear line judging it from
exactly. That's what I mean.
Food was wrong. And I also think it's quite a stretch to say it has to be a linear relationship, just from first principles. Like, where would you get them? But people have often argued that he was not wrong, but just didn't get the timing right, and that population exponential increases because of the nature of exponentials, and that food... I think what we can say is that food production isn't growing exponentially. Whatever increase that line is, there will always be a crossover point somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think also right now people make a certain prediction of where the human population will be kept. And I think right now people say something like 11 billion. I think that's the number I've heard recently, but not sure what this is based on. And maybe again, another revolution might change this. What do you think? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's like really hard to tell if it can't be done to increase food production exponentially, right? Because that depends largely on our ingenuity and technology, right? And while you're living the process, it might look like linear growth, but if you zoom out far enough, then you can see that it's actually exponential. So I think making the assumption that food production is always going to be or can't be exponential, I don't know. Like, theoretically, we could start growing crops somewhere in the galaxy, right? Like, it doesn't have to be here necessarily. And like, I'm saying that for his initial hypothesis, he was proving wrong, and it's yet to see if he is proven right in the long term. But I don't think we can say that with any kind of certainty at the moment.
No, but some people postulated a new crossover point for him. So that, and that is based basically on the surface, habitable surface area of the globe. So if we chopped everything down and we turned everything into fields and we used our most efficient form of protein production, let's call it the soybean. I'm not actually sure what is the best plant for protein production, but whatever, let's go for it. And we harvested the seeds and we planted the seeds with seaweed and harvested them. Like, then there's still a cap on the total amount of food we can produce to feed humanity. And what's interesting with the Solene system is that we vastly increase this now, we probably have to use nuclear power because solar panels do require surface area. So let's move on to using something like nuclear power to power the process, and they can form as much protein as needed by just pumping through these reactors. Like the footprint of the reactor compared to a field is tiny, and that's what that's a huge thing. So we might be reaching a point where a technology, a lot like the Harbour process, is introduced, which will give us a step change in the total amount of protein and food that we can produce as a species.
I think like maybe the better way to think about it is like, what's the bottleneck, right? Because I would assume we can agree on the fact that resources are limited on this planet, and you cannot go on with exponential growth of humans because at some point something is gonna run out. So if I understand you correctly, if that technology actually works and they can deliver on upscaling it, that basically means that food might not be the limiting factor, but something else instead. Which would be amazing.
And I think people would say energy is, but maybe I guess these two technologies go hand in hand. The, I don't want to say energy crisis, but the, let's say, increasing energy demand for humanity is being tackled from different ways. And I think the new technology people look at is nuclear fusion, for example. Mm. And let's just say this thing works in the next 10, 20 years, which people have been saying since the 80s, apparently, but still, this time it's definitely going to work.
This would give us the ability, for sure.
Exactly. This would give us the ability to also, let's say, if energy, the energy problem is out of the equation, consequently, through solar foods or similar technologies, the food problem is also out of the equation. Is that what you're saying, Chris? Is this how this works?
Exactly. Yeah.
That is fascinating.
And that's exciting. There's one super nerdy area that it is exciting for, and I think it's for space travel, because it claims to be a more efficient process to produce protein. And actually, this for the long-term space travel, how we would produce food to live would be one of the more pressing problems, because weight is such a problem. Weight and volume are such a problem getting them off Earth before. So that could be super cool. And I think as a technology for that, it may be suitable, and people will take it based on its purely on its scientific and economic merits. It may come off Earth. But what I want to ask you is, do you think we should pursue this as a technology on Earth if all we do is produce another cycle? So instead of being capped at 11 billion, we decide that 20 billion is now the cap for humanity, and with all the consequences of waste that's produced. So we tend as a species to not account for the waste that a thing produces. We cost the inputs, so the energy and the raw material to make something, but we don't add the cost of destroying the thing after we've done it to the cost of the good. And at the moment, protein is extremely cheap. It's terrible that you can buy a chicken for $10 or £5, whatever. It's the chicken's life is summed up in that amount of money. Is terrifying to think about. And the way it's done is with this bulk production of protein, soybeans basically, which is killing the planet. The other problem is the chicken produces a lot of effluent, and nitrogen goes into our rivers, into the sea, and causes these massive dead zones. And so the solar foods, I keep saying solar, it's really bad. The solene that they're producing fixes a lot of nitrogen into the system and will be excreted out. You can take solene and you could feed it to chickens if you wanted to eat chicken after the whole process. It's inefficient, but people are weird in that sense. But then we're still going to build up huge amounts of nitrates into the soils, into the rivers, into the thing. And now with 20 billion people in humanity, is that a good idea? We don't have sufficient efforts to capture this waste and account for the waste that we're producing.
I have a couple of thoughts. I think the first one is, yes, proteins are cheap, but that's also very Western perspective. B, relatively speaking, I think protein is still the most expensive, let's say, macronutrient that you need to get. Like if you compare it to sugar or any other kind of, like, let's say carbohydrate, it's a lot cheaper. So I think it's still the bottleneck in terms of macronutrients, even in terms of price. And then, yeah, I definitely agree with the fact that we haven't talked about the ethics of having like factory farming of animals. Like that would sidestep a whole big, big problem that we are, yeah, basically torturing animals to get our protein into large groups of populations. Which I think even alone, even just for that, it would be enough to adopt the technology.
Yeah.
I am completely with you on this one, Philip. And again, I guess we're preaching to the choir and we should have more controversy on the podcast. I can't take another stance. It's exactly that. I think at this point, I don't actually know about the scale of waste problems that you mentioned, Chris. So I can't actually say for sure, just because I lack the data, I can't say, well, the waste is such a concern, maybe you should keep getting chicken or whatever other animal. For a basic nutritious value, I guess people will always keep eating animals because they think it's right and because they enjoy it. And fair enough, I can tell anyone what to do. But if it's just for basic nutrition and something people don't enjoy on any level, then I think the more ethical and more environmentally friendly option is, of course, a thing we have to go for. And yeah, can you tell me more about the problem with the waste? You mentioned a few things, but what exactly is the problem now, apart from maybe the waste that comes with the energy production?
So first of all, can I add a correction? I was using the chicken example as a current day example of why our high protein diets in the West cause a lot of waste that is not factored into when we buy our cheap chicken. And so if Solein was turned on and we were eating only Solein, we would also be excreting a lot of nitrogen into the system. And it's unclear whether that nitrogen, I think with modern sewage treatment that can be dealt with, but with chicken farms and that sort of thing, the protein is just put into giant tanks, spread on fields, or in illegal cases, left off into the rivers. And that excess nitrogen and phosphates in particular are crucial problems for ecosystems and killing large swathes of the sea and rivers that we currently live with. So that's what I was sort of trying to get at there. I think it will be interesting to see how this technology, whether the technology will come good with the promises it's making. I think that for me, the most worrying phrase is with vitamins and minerals. So a bit like with the idea of lab-grown meat being a wholly innocent form of production for some protein that's tasty, actually it still requires animals to suffer in some cases. I think they've got around this now, but you know, you still used animal-derived products to make the meat. What are the inputs to Solein and solar foods? That will be the next crisis. Like, do they mine some very specific mineral from some space, and that will become the limiting factor, as Philip said, for the production.
Yeah, I think it's very valid. Like, usually with new technologies, we just jump in and we're like, oh yeah, nice cars, awesome, everybody can get everywhere fast, and not considering what it does to the planet and the atmosphere and climate change down the line. So I think it's very valid to think about this for sure, although it feels like just if they can deliver what they promise, it feels like the better system. Like, even if you say cheaper protein leads to more consumption, more humans, which leads to more waste, which is true, but I would also assume that the same process would happen if you don't have these kinds of options. You would have more chicken farms, maybe more cruel or more efficient systems to do this and that kind of stuff. So I don't see how that process is going to stop, even if we don't integrate these kinds of technologies. So I'm thinking it's definitely a step up if they can deliver. We also haven't talked about taste. I think that's going to be a pretty big test if that actually flies. And I also would like to say that, I mean, I'm already eating a lot of protein powder, right? So at least half the protein I have in my diet comes from some kind of protein powder-ish, I would say. So me personally, I don't think I wouldn't mind. Like, I don't care what my protein powder is coming from, right? Like, if it's some kind of, like, as long as I don't taste the difference, like, I don't care. It's not like my protein powder tastes better if a chicken had to die for it. Like, I don't think people will care if the product has high enough quality or taste.
I think that's a low bar, though. Protein powders already taste pretty rancid. Like, they're dry.
What I'm saying is people eat it. I do eat it. So, you know, like, it's just a measure of convincing people and making it convenient and, you know.
From what I've seen, and they say they can produce, I think, a kilo in their reactor currently. They've made pancakes with it, and they've fused it in these kind of things.
That's the bad sign.
It's identical to the protein powder you get as you know, bodybuilders and athletes use. It's that kind of... it's nothing. It just is a kind of dry powder.
I don't think we have to fool ourselves. It's never going to be a luxury product, but when it comes tackling... famines and just, I guess, nutritious bottlenecks in general, it's better than nothing, right? You would always eat it if you had no other option. If it's something that is environmentally friendly and is able to sustain you, then of course, I guess you would eat it.
So the
question is, would the first world, if they don't have to?
So the interesting thing is you have to apply to, currently they're applying to the FDA and the EU, or certainly the EU, to make it a foodstuff. Because it's technically not food at the moment. It would be called an industrial chemical or something like this now. And so with any new food stuff, you have to apply for approval. And this is what's happening at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting question. Like when we think of food, we know inherently what we're talking about. But is this newly derived source of protein, A, safe to eat? There might be all sorts of horrible things inside of it that we don't know about. And B... will it be given to humans? It's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the end, it's inevitable. It's gonna come. If it's cheaper and better for the planet, latest when you have something like a carbon tax, which I don't think we are gonna get around either way, then at some point it's just gonna become more competitive, even if the taste is bad, right? You could have like you have your protein foundation being solved by these kinds of products, and then once a week you get fish or like a steak or something, you know, and that costs then your steak costs then 120 euros, and you're like, yeah, okay, maybe once a week or twice, like every other week or something. I'd be down 100%.
I see you down.
I'm not particularly excited about eating a lot of protein powder, I have to say, at all. But I think I would. I'm pro the technology, definitely. If it holds what it promises, absolutely. I think it's a great thing to do to uncouple food production from... what are we uncoupling it from? From the carbon cycle of life, if you will.
It would be nice to have like a microwave-sized thing. Like that just produces protein for you in your own home.
I mean, of course, at some point we're going to have fusion reactors in our basements, like maybe one per neighborhood or something. And you will have a tiny vat in your kitchen that makes protein powder for you. And every morning you open some kind of drawer you take out, you tap it a bit because it's a bit sticky at the point, you dry it, and then you eat it. That's exactly how things are going to be.
And I think that on that bombshell, we can end with, well, that requires further research. Thank you.
See you guys in 2 weeks.